Well, I hope you won't think that I'm a killjoy and a misery guts, but I want to focus for a few minutes this morning on the darker side of the Christmas story. Of course, the Christmas story is a very happy story. It's good news. It's the greatest news the world has ever received. But at the same time, it's not just the story of a virgin birth and a newborn baby and singing angels and rejoicing shepherds and worshipping magi. It's also the story of a ruthless king. His name is Herod. And it's Herod's opposition to Jesus Christ, then, upon which I'd just like us to reflect for a few minutes this morning, basing our reflections on this passage that we read, Matthew chapter 2. And just two things, then, that I want to draw to your attention. First of all, a reckless opposition. A reckless opposition. Because you see, it isn't that Herod is a skeptic when it comes to Jesus Christ, unimpressed with the idea that he is great and extraordinary and supernatural. That's not the case. Herod is no skeptic. He knows very well that that star in the east means exactly what the Magi say it means, that someone has been born king of the Jews. That's why he's so disturbed by their report in verse 3. He knows very well that the advent of a Messiah has been on the cards for centuries. That's why he asks all his advisors in verse 4 when the Christ, the Messiah, is to be born. And he knows very well that the combined significance then of the celestial sign and the Old Testament prophecy is that a major development has taken place in Bethlehem. That's why in verse 8 he sends the Magi there as his scouts. As redemption's happy dawn then breaks here in front of King Herod's eyes, he doesn't mock, he doesn't trifle. He recognizes what's going on here. He understands who Jesus is. He understands what a bunch of Galilean fishermen will later understand, and it compelled them to surrender the rest of their lives to Jesus. He understands what a tax collector called Levi will later understand, and it compelled him to surrender the rest of his life to Jesus. He understands what a Jewish terrorist called Saul will later understand, and it compelled him to surrender the rest of his life to Jesus. He understands what many of us in this room this morning would later understand, and it has compelled us to surrender the rest of our lives to Jesus. Herod understands Jesus' sublime, unique, glorious identity. But in his case, it doesn't compel him to surrender the rest of his life to Jesus. Instead, knowing everything, knowing the truth, knowing the facts, Herod yet persists in reckless opposition to him. In other words, what I'm saying is this. It isn't that Herod doesn't believe the truth about Jesus. It's rather that Herod doesn't want the truth about Jesus. It isn't that Herod finds Jesus incredible, it's rather that Herod finds Jesus inconvenient. It isn't that Herod has an intellectual problem with Jesus Christ, it's rather that Herod has a practical problem with Jesus Christ. His position isn't, I can't accept King Jesus because of the evidence, because the evidence is inadequate. His position is, I won't accept King Jesus, because the implications are so far-reaching. And of course, the implications were far-reaching for Herod, weren't they? When he wrapped himself in his royal robes and looked at himself in the mirror, Herod could easily convince himself of his own unrivaled splendor and dignity and majesty and preeminence. He could easily convince himself that the world was privileged to have him, and that history would always remember him. He could easily convince himself that he was something really quite special. But if this newborn baby down the road in Bethlehem, if he was a king from heaven, if he was a king from God, if he was a king that the world had for centuries been waiting and groaning for, then it would mean that Herod would have to abandon his pride and bow before a higher authority. It would mean that Herod would have to join those stinking shepherds in Bethlehem and that decrepit old couple in the Jerusalem temple, Anna and Simeon, and become a humble worshipper. It would mean that Herod would have to forget his own pretended glory and acknowledge the true glory of someone else. And that was just too much for Herod. It was just too big a price to pay. He just couldn't bring himself to do that. He wasn't prepared to bow before a greater authority than him and recognize that there was a more important person on this planet than Herod. And that's why he persisted in this opposition of Jesus Christ. And I suspect you know that it generally is the case whenever anybody rejects Jesus Christ and refuses to become a Christian. Oh yes, people might come out with all kinds of skeptical arguments and all kinds of intellectual objections. But I suspect you know that deep down, like Herod, they know that it's all true. Perhaps you're someone this morning who is a skeptic. You claim to be a skeptic about Jesus Christ. And perhaps you think what I'm saying just now is jolly impertinent. And you think that I've got no right to say such things. Well, don't be offended. Just listen to what I'm saying. You know, don't you, deep down, that the Jesus who preached the Sermon on the Mount was no mere product of history. You know deep down that those men and women who were ultimately martyred for claiming that Jesus had risen from the dead and they had seen him weren't laying down their lives for something they had made up. You know deep down that the Gospels aren't silly, fabulous accounts like so many of the accounts of religious figures from the past. You know deep down that there's something uninventable, something irresistibly credible about the person and the claims and the mission of Jesus Christ. You know it deep down, but you won't become a Christian because the implications are too big. It's too big a step. It's too big a thing to come and bow down and surrender your life to him. And I concur, the implications are far-reaching. Jesus is a king to whose will one must yield in every decision, in every activity, in every relationship, in every single area of life. The implications are very far-reaching when you come and bow down as a worshipper of Jesus Christ. But the implications are also wonderful. He's the king of love. He's the king who offers forgiveness for every sin that you have ever committed through his own shed blood at Calvary's cross. He's the king who offers protection from eternal judgment. He's the king who offers a hope which stretches even beyond the end of history itself. He's the king who offers guidance and provision and companionship in all the circumstances of life. Yes, it's true that when you become a Christian, in one sense, you lose your life. You lose your independence. You lose your license to live as you please. You lose your self-governance. But as Jesus himself promised, in losing your life, you really do find it. You find that suddenly you're in this relationship with the most wonderful person in the whole universe, this beautiful, fulfilling, satisfying, saving, transforming relationship with the most sublime king of all. And nobody ever, ever lives to regret it. Herod's opposition was a reckless opposition. He knew the facts, but he didn't like the facts. And I'm saying this morning, don't be a Herod yourself, but come and lose your life by submitting yourself to Jesus Christ, but in losing it, find it, that so many in this room have this morning. That's the first thing there, a reckless opposition. Secondly, a futile opposition. A futile opposition. Because I suppose actually Herod's opposition to Jesus was reckless in more ways than one, wasn't it? It was reckless, as we've just said, in its defiance of everything Herod knew to be true about Jesus Christ. He knew he was the messianic king to whom he was obliged to bow the knee, but he carried on opposing him anyway. It was reckless in that sense, but his opposition was also reckless in its sheer intensity. Herod didn't simply attempt to sideline Jesus, did he? He didn't simply attempt to make life difficult for Jesus. He attempted to annihilate Jesus, even if it meant a blanket annihilation of all Bethlehem's male infants in the process. There was no moderation with Herod. There was no realism with Herod. There was no sense of proportion with Herod. He just went crazy in his attempt to abort the advent of the Messiah. And on the face of things, therefore, things don't look very good for this newborn baby in Bethlehem, do they? No doubt at some point over this festive period, the film Home Alone will be shown. And in that film then, you have this 8-year-old boy who is left home alone when his parents accidentally go on holiday and forget him. And the storyline then is this rather far-fetched affair of this 8-year-old boy outwitting two burglars who want to break into the house. And through all kinds of means then, as I say, he scuppers their plan and outwits them. But it raises the question, if it's far-fetched for an 8-year-old boy to outwit a pair of burglars, then how on earth is this little baby going to outwit this mighty king who is trying desperately to wipe him out? Well, as you begin to work through the particularly the second half of this passage, you soon begin to realize, don't you, that this baby is actually going to be fine. You soon begin to realize that actually Herod's opposition is futile. You soon begin to realize that in attempting to wipe out Jesus, Herod has taken on more than he bargained for and has found himself fighting against none other than God himself. You begin to realize that in verses 9 to 11. After they had heard the king, that's the Magi, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him, and so on. Now, it's one thing, isn't it, for an unfamiliar star to appear suddenly there in the east, where the Magi are watching the skies. It's another thing altogether for a star to actually lead these Magi to the very house where baby Jesus is located. Now, I don't know how this worked. I can't envisage it in my mind. I would have thought that if this star was in the sky, then it would be pretty hard to tell whether it had stopped over that house or that house or that house or even over which village. But as I say, I don't know how it worked, but it did work. It led them to the very place. And it's an initial indication then, isn't it, that Herod is out of his depth here. He is fighting against a God who can cause stars to stop over individual houses. And then you move on to verses 12 and 13. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up and take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. And so in the first instance then, information which Herod wants to be divulged to him, namely the whereabouts of the baby, is withheld from him. And then in the second instance, information which Herod wants to be withheld from Mary and Joseph, namely that there's about to be this massacre in Bethlehem, is divulged to them. And in both instances, a dream is involved. And again, then, it's shown as Herod is out of his depth in this battle. He's fighting against a god who can influence people even through their dreams in the night. Then you move on to verses 14 and 15. So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Many centuries earlier, Hosea, an Old Testament prophet, had spoken those words. He had spoken of the Son of God being brought back from Egypt. And Matthew is saying that in Jesus' flight to Egypt and his subsequent return, those words are being fulfilled. And again, it's shown us Herod is out of his depth here. He's fighting against a god who had pre-planned all of this many centuries ago. And so you see what I'm saying, that on the face of things, baby Jesus may seem a very easy target for mighty King Herod. But you see, Herod isn't just taking on baby Jesus. He's taking on the God who stands behind baby Jesus. The God who has sent baby Jesus. This God who can control the movements of stars. This God who can directly access people's minds in their sleep. This God who has decided everything that's going to happen before it ever occurs. And I'm saying then that before this God, all Herod's tactics, his ruthlessness, his determination, his military force, all of those are pathetic. It's a futile opposition that Herod is mounting, because he's mounting it against this amazing, all-resourceful God. But perhaps the most telling little expression here of Herod's futility, the futility of his opposition, comes in verse 19, two words: Herod died. After Herod died, ... You see, Herod has been pulling out all the stops in his determination to bring about the death of Jesus. But the only one who dies here is Herod himself. Jesus doesn't die here. Herod is the one who dies. Reminds me a bit of that famous bit of graffiti concerning Friedrich Nietzsche. You know how Nietzsche was the 19th century philosopher who famously and confidently announced God is dead. And upon his death in 1900, a bit of graffiti appeared somewhere. It was two lines. The first line was in inverted commas, "God is dead, Nietzsche." And then the second line under that was, "Nietzsche is dead, God." And there's a sense of that here, isn't there? That here, as Herod tries to wipe out Jesus, he's the one who dies. Jesus carries on. Jesus' march is irresistibly on, via those 30 quiet years in Nazareth, via those 3 years of preaching and teaching and healing, via supremely his own sacrifice at Calvary. He marches on to that moment where he can cry out in such triumph, "It is finished. I have done everything I set out to do." He marches on triumphantly as Herod's remains rot in some grave in Jerusalem. And again, it's always the way. Opposition to Jesus Christ is futile. You can spend your life rebutting and debunking and mocking and denouncing Jesus Christ. But Jesus isn't going to go away. He will continue to reign over the whole of the universe from his glorious heavenly throne. He will continue to be worshipped every moment of every hour by countless angels. He will continue to build his church throughout the whole world. And then one day he will come again, and he will judge the living and the dead, and he will allocate to all men an eternal destiny based upon their response to him and the gospel. Jesus isn't going to go away. But one day you will go away, One day you go the same way as King Herod and Friedrich Nietzsche. One day you will die. And I'm saying to you, therefore, drop your futile, silly opposition to Jesus Christ. And devote the rest of your life to a king and to a kingdom that is going to last forever. Devote the rest of your life to something that's meaningful and worthwhile. Your opposition to Jesus will count for nothing in the end. It will not so much as leave a single dent in his kingdom and in his cause and in his church. Jesus will do everything he has set out to do. And one day you will stand before him. And I'm saying before that, drop your opposition to him and live a life of meaning and significance in his service for the King of Kings, whose glory will last forever. And as I said before, you'll never regret it. Drop your reckless opposition, drop your futile opposition, and this Christmas, join with the Magi in worshipping Jesus Christ. Amen. We're going to close with number 206. Hark, the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn king.